to remark this evening. The first is, let us be sure we do not forget, my dear people, that the most perfect charity is to reign among us. I'm sure that if you have any sense of the realities in which we live, you understand that the devil will try to destroy this little community of Catholics. If you're not aware of how the devil hates what we stand for, I hope that before I finish, you at least have had an opportunity to give the matter some thought. The primary rule about charity, I would say, a very basic and very obvious obligation that a person needs to practice with respect to charity is that he must mind his own business. Which is to say, a person ought to know what his business is and be able to delineate his from everybody else's and everybody else's from his own. This ought to be a simple matter, but I dare say that a lot of unkindness and a lot of things would not be said if people would just remember that a lot of things that they are inclined to say, it is not their business even to observe, much less say anything about. Everybody ought to know, as I say, what his business is. And it so happens that God, in giving us our province of affairs, gives us no more than we can take care of. And if we take care of what is our affair perfectly, we will be saints. And one of the reasons why so few of us is saintly is that we don't know the difference between our business and other people's. And in order that we might better mind our own business, we ought not to see a lot of things that we might observe. It is better just not to see it, to ignore things around us in other people's lives. Just let it be. Don't see their faults. You say, well, I'm bound to see their faults. They annoy me. And I say, well, try not to see them and act as if you have not seen them. Do not even think of them. Or the thoughts of their children. Try not to see them. Then you won't remark on them. Remember, you're not supposed to be busying yourself about other people's troubles, other people's difficulties, other people's sins. That is not your affair. As St. Paul would say, your affair, your business, is to give thanks to God. Secondly, in the chapel here, be sure that you exercise greatest reverence. The style of the day, as you know, is to treat the chapel, the church, as a meeting place, a place where people get together and have a religious free-for-all, not knowing what kind of entertainment is going to be served up to us today, not knowing what the president is going to spring on us in order that we will be properly entertained. This is not either our affair. Our affair is to be aware that this is the house of God. There is no more holy area in the whole world. And therefore, our demeanor, everything about our attitude, our bearing, should manifest to God and to each other that this is where Jesus Christ is corporeally present. And our obligation, our need, is to focus on that fact constantly while we are here. To attend to the fact of the great mystery that it is our grace to believe that Christ is here. If anyone were in the tabernacle, it would be a miracle. No one can get into the tabernacle. But Christ is here not simply to perform the feats of being so small, but in being so small to be so grand. And to be ours, he is here because we need him here. We need all the power that comes forth from his body, the power of God. Now, I want you to remember that we should manifest flawless reverence. And we should insist that all the children not treat this place as if it were any other. That they not talk for any reason. That they not be allowed to sit with anyone who will be a cause of distraction. That they not let themselves be distracted by the little children, the infants here. Remember, our business is to concentrate on this august mystery, that Christ is here, and during Mass, that Christ offers himself to the Father for our sakes. And through this holy sacrifice, we have something to give to Almighty God, namely ourselves, and we have a way to do it, without which there is no way. When you come to Holy Communion, and generally when you are here, fold your hands. This is the way to fold your hands. I'm instructing you young people, in case you've never had it said to you. There's only one way. All your fingers together, your hands in the middle of your chest, the right thumb over the left thumb. Very simple, but very proper. As I say, don't do it this way, don't do it this way, don't do it this way. Don't make your own way up as if you've just invented something great. Notice, everyone. It's never been thought of until this very day. This is the way you're supposed to do, and all you grown-ups should give this example so that the young people do not think that it is not grown-up to do it. Because before our Lord, as you grow up, you're really no bigger than the smallest thing. I wonder if you realize how serious a thing is this matter of their now allowing everyone to touch the Blessed Eucharist. You know as well as I that there is serious doubt as to whether there is a real consecration in the new Mass. If any of you doubts that, talk to me afterward and I will give you reason for doubting. But I think most of you here are aware that there is serious question. And while we do not treat the new Mass as authentic, and while we do not treat the host that comes from the new Mass as if it were the true Eucharist, neither would we treat the host from the new Mass with any irreverence on the slight possibility that it is the body of Christ. I have been trying to analyze how it is possible that they have been able to brainwash the Catholic world into thinking that there is some usefulness or advantage to handing the host to everyone. Little children who can't go 5 minutes without getting their hands dirty. Old people sometimes who are so unsteady that they have to have two hands free just to make it. people who are not Catholic, whether they say they are or say they are not. I've been trying to wonder, or I should say to figure out, how it is possible that they have convinced the bishops that there is some practicality or some advantage to giving the host out in such a random and such an altogether unreasonable form and fashion. Now this is an example, my dear people, of brainwashing, pure and simple. Brainwashing is the process by which you cause people not to react in a rational form, to be able to go contrary to their normal way of thinking, to disregard all the logic and all the principles which they normally function by. When a person is brainwashed, it is only in a certain area of thought. It is not as if the person is altogether disconnected with reality. But on this particular matter, on this particular area of his thinking, he cannot function logically. He cannot function logically because there has been dinned into his ear and possibly into his brain a certain procedure of thought, a certain, you might say, train of thought, that he is unable to analyze logically. And unfortunately, in the process of this brainwashing, there is cast around the whole matter such a fog, as it were. The matter is so disconnected that whenever you raise objection to it, it is as if it blows a fuse and nothing happens. As if there is no functioning of the brain. That is why if you ask certain strategic and telling questions to the new Catholics, there is that little lapse of time in which you perceive there is no connection. They are unable to figure out exactly what to say. And then, as if the motor has somehow connected again, they give you the thing that the priest has said in the pulpit that they are to say whenever this kind of question arises. And their answer is always totally unrelated to your question. In other words, there is no logic in what they answer, but it is a certain slogan, or it is a certain shibboleth which comes to their mind like the saliva in Pavlov's dog. Again, I remind you that, and this is for you younger ones who may never have heard of Pavlov's dog, he happens to have come in our car today. He usually does not travel with me, but I wanted you to know, and any of you young people, I will show him to you after if you want to meet him. Anyhow, Pavlov's dog was a dog, or was a kind of dog that he used, any kind of dog, he performed experiments on. And again, I'm talking to you young people. He wanted to condition the dog to react or to study the reactions of the dog by causing certain things to happen upon the dog's thinking processes or brain activity, if you will. So first he would put a bit of meat out for the dog, and then he would ring a bell and put the meat out, and of course the dog would begin to associate the bell with the meat, and he would begin to salivate when he heard the bell. And then he would salivate when he heard the bell and no meat was given. And then the the technique was changed in such a way that he could cause the dog to salivate when there was no bell nor any meat. But he could so control the dog's reactions simply by repeating certain kinds of processes. And this is the same procedure that is now being worked upon the Catholic people in order to get them to do things which are contrary to what they think is their religion. Now, for instance, if the Catholic people were to see the priest with a host in his own hand, they would notice it. And they would say, that's not reverent. The priest is not supposed to hold up. He always holds this way. As a matter of fact, my dear people, the priest is not permitted to hold the host in the palm of his hand. That's against the rules that are set up. And I don't think most priests who give the host into the palm of other people's hands will have ever had the host in the palm of their own. And if you say, well, why don't you do that? Why don't you do that this way? The priest would have a reaction. And yet if you would ask him why, he would, as I say, not have a ready reason. Now, if you talk to any of these these interior Catholics, see if you can get this person to think of this answer. And if you talk to any priests, ask them this question. What good does it do for you to touch the host? What possible good does it do you? Why is there a necessity for it? Now, the reason why I urge you to use such forceful language is that you have to overpower their attention. You have to try to get them to think. Because in these areas, they no longer think. They have been stupefied by the repetition, conditioning effects, or culture. They're incapable of thinking straight anymore in this area. If they thought the way they do with regard to their religion in any other area, they'd be run down because they would not have any power of self-preservation. If you have an opportunity to talk to a priest on this matter, ask him this question. What would you do if you were in charge of a cleaning establishment and found a host in the trouser pockets of a little boy? What would you do? If you call the priest, you are aware that obviously it is the priest's fault that the little boy, for whatever reason, put the host in his pocket. What would you do if you were cleaning a church and you almost took up a host with a vacuum cleaner or swept up a host? What would you do? Now you can talk to the priest and say, well, suppose I am such a person. Is there any need for me to contact you because you believe that it is not important? And he would say, oh, I think it is important. It is important. Little boys shouldn't put hosts in their pockets. They're supposed to take it into their mouths. And people shouldn't just discard the host. Really, Father? Well, Father, do you feel that you have any obligation to do anything lest this happen? And then you say, you see, Father, for the past 10, 11, 12 years, you have conditioned the people to have no reverence for the host. And you have used the fact that in the early church, they allowed people to take the host to their homes, to break the host, and to have the host to take the Eucharist themselves in their families. That was a custom in the early church. And you have allowed this fact to be your argumentation for your reinstituting it. But in the early church, they did not do this without the assurance that the people had a great, a profound reverence. You remember the story of Tarsus, a little boy, possibly 10 years old, and as far as I can ascertain, this is a true story. It's not one of the early Christian legends. St. Tarsus, as he became, was the only one that they thought could get into the prison to take the Blessed Eucharist to the Christians away from martyrdom in Rome. And on his way, Tarsus carried a host thus. I hasten to say, we do not know that he was carrying the host the way they carried. Probably it was properly wrapped, but this was a permissible action. Even whether it was prudent, it was permissible. The church later decided that such things were not prudent because of just such episodes as I'm going to describe. It happened that while Tarsus was on his way, some of his acquaintances, boys, were playing in the street, and they asked him to come and play. And when he kept moving on his way, they began to importune him to join them. And then they forgot their game, and they caught up with him, as you can imagine boys would do. And they got a little bit difficult, and they insisted that he come and play. And then they, one or the other of them, observed that he was carrying something. And he couldn't get away from them. And they began to pull at him to find out what it was that he was carrying. And by the power of God, he was able to keep them from doing it. But in their anger, they began to kick him and beat him, because, of course, boys don't like, as men don't like, to find someone stronger in such a situation. And they all but killed him. When finally a crowd gathers, and among them a priest, and the priest finds that Tarsus gives the host to him. And then Tarsus died. The point is, of course, that St. Tarsus was allowed to carry the host because he knew what it was and he had reverence for it. And I can imagine that we live in an era where in the not too distant future, we may have young boys and girls carrying the host to people in prison. And the people who will not be in prison will be those who dare to touch the host now. Because it is those people who will dare to touch the host now that will be brainwashed into thinking that those people whom they are rounding up need to be rounded up. And it is the kind of people who kicked and killed Tarsus who have no reverence for the Eucharist. Let it be, therefore, our ideal here to have nothing but the most exquisite reverence for the Holy Father. I cannot insist to you, my dear people, how the devil hates the host sufficiently. I cannot insist to you how communists hate the Catholic Church insisting. I cannot bring home to you, I do not think, how terrible, how chronic, and how insatiable is the hatred of most Jews for the name of Christ. I cannot describe to you what communists want to do. The avowed, the fanatic communist wants to destroy everyone who opposes him. And he thinks that it is not only necessary, but he thinks he is going to get the opportunity, and he means to get it. There is nothing delicate, there is nothing secretive, and there is nothing unproven about what I'm saying. The typical communist who is behind all these violations of the Eucharist wants to get his hands on anything sacred, anything that does not represent his idea of what the world is going to be. And if you are so childish, or so naive, or so, what shall I say, brainwashed, not to be convinced of this after all that has occurred, what would it take? We live in an era that has no equal in history. The devil has never had the whole world as he now has for his plaything. He has never found a church leaders so cooperative, so stupid with regard to what they're supposed to be and what they represent. He has never found the Pope so anxious to stamp out that which is truly kind. He has never found it. So unapologetically so, he has never found it. He has never had such a freewheeling manner. He has never found it so easy to destroy souls. I hope that this comes home to you, because this is the era in which we live, and you are the target. And if you're not going to rise to the occasion, then you are going to miss the grace which God has called you to. There is nothing more glorious in what you're called to, but I assure you, it is serious business. So let us gain our strength from this place and from Christ, who is our food. Let us gain our strength from Him, because it will take more than human strength.